Well, welcome back, Class of Earth Science 2150. Welcome back to Radio Solar System. Now embarking on Module 3 of this course. So we've had some introductory material so far, and then we've taken you through a bit of background material, talked about some background science information, which I hope many of you are familiar with, and then some background information on some geological concepts and things that we'll need in the latter part of the course. So you're probably feeling a little bit burnt out after the last set of classes. So today what we're going to do in the first part of this module is really start out with an introduction to kind of historical, the history of observations of the solar system, and some thoughts about modern observations of the solar system. And then in the second part of the module, we'll talk a bit about the wider context of the solar system within the galaxy and also within the wider universe. So we're going to take quite a long trip to the distant realms of the cosmos as we go through this. So once again, you'll hear a distinctive sound when it's time to change the slide, like now. And then we'll have a look first at the plan for today. So first of all, I want to say a few things about the long human interest in looking at the heavens. This is a very ancient human activity, really. It goes back as far as human beings go back in terms of keeping any records at all. Okay? And then talk a bit about some of the ways in which we gain information about the solar system and some of the things that we can easily observe in the night sky that our ancestors would have been easily able to observe even back in the days when we were living in caves or straw huts and different things like that. Okay, so it's a very general introduction. We're going to talk more later on about the development of astronomy as a science, which kind of began really with astrology and then became more of a science. And then we'll talk a little bit about some of the components within the solar system. Progressively in the next few classes, we're going to introduce a little bit more each time about the makeup of the solar system, its geometry, the things that are placed in there, what the scale is, and all of these sorts of features. So I've got a range of things to cover today. So let's move along. Let's not waste any time. Well, first of all, as I said, ever since we've been around, we've been looking at the skies. It's certainly an activity that's as old as agriculture, and I'll explain why that is in a minute. Probably has a link to agriculture too, initially. Now, our ancestors were a bit limited in what they could actually see. They didn't have telescopes or binoculars or anything of that nature, but they had clear skies, you can be sure of that. And there's a lot of things that they could see in the sky. In the daytime, you could see the sun because it emits light. Other objects in the solar system are visible because they reflect sunlight. We can see the moon during the daytime because it reflects the sun's light. In the nighttime, the stars twinkle, and we could always look up at them. And I imagine that for thousands and thousands of years, human beings have wondered what they were, and then found connections between the motions of objects in the heavens and the seasons, the climate that they could see around them. When agriculture started, it became important to understand the timing of things, the calendar, where you were within the year and within the variations in the weather that that entailed. So really, this is something that goes right back to the beginning of human investigation. So now to the next slide. You can create visions of the sky very easily on your computer these days. It was recorded thousands of years ago too. Although we don't really have as many records as would be ideal from those times, but we do know that observations were being made of celestial motions of various objects thousands and thousands of years ago. And probably the first people to do this, like most aspects of human civilization, were in the area that we now call the Middle East. So if we go to the next slide, the oldest written records that we have of actual astronomical data come from about 3000 BC, and they were made in the Sumerian civilization, or the Sumerian area, which occupies much of what would now be modern-day Iraq and parts of Iran. Now, Sumeria eventually became part of the Babylonian Empire, which was a larger enterprise, and they continued to make astronomical observations, quite detailed observations. But we might ask ourselves, what was the interest here? What was the interest in stargazing and trying to understand the motions of celestial objects? Well, really, it was very practical in a lot of senses. Next slide. This is a baked clay tablet, and it actually records observations of the planet Venus from before 3000 BC. And there are lunar calendars that exist from the same period too. Right? And there are a whole series of star catalogues that come from the 8th century BC, and astronomical diaries that take us right through from the 7th century to the 1st century BC. So these are very ancient records, and it's no surprise that many of the stars in the sky have names that actually derive from ancient languages in the Middle East, and particularly from Arabic. Modern Arabic has contributed many star names that exist for places in the sky that we look at. So astronomy kind of grew over time from a much less scientific subject that we call astrology. And astrology was based around trying to predict future events by observing celestial events, which is a rather dodgy proposition, as you might imagine. But there was a very practical side to understanding all this too, because there's a very close link between the motions of objects in the heavens and the seasons on the earth. And that was a very important factor for early civilizations to understand the calendars, the times to plant crops, the times to harvest crops, and so on and so forth. Next slide now. Well, the next slide is a place that's quite famous. This is Stonehenge in England, on Salisbury Plain in southern England. And stone circles like this are quite common around the world. Stonehenge is probably one of the best examples, and it dates from around that same period, about 3000 BCE. But many other structures were probably made before this and are not as well preserved, going back perhaps as far as 5000 BC. And Stonehenge is considered to be an astronomical observatory. Okay? It's a place where you can record the motions of the sun and understand the calendar, which was very important for ancient societies. So let's just take a look at the next slide and find out a little bit about how this works. So every time there's a significant event, particularly the summer solstice, the spring equinox, the fall equinox, the sun rises through an opening in a different set of stones. So these stones were designed to coincide with the position on the horizon where the sun would rise on particular dates within the calendar. And modern people, modern Britons, still gather at Stonehenge and dress up in Druid costumes on June the 21st to celebrate the summer solstice. And in fact, it's become a bit of a challenge to actually manage this event because sometimes thousands of people go there in June. So this was the primary purpose of something like Stonehenge. It was to tell you what time of the year you were in. If it was the spring equinox, well, maybe it was time to start thinking about planting and growing crops. If it's the fall equinox, perhaps it's the time for a harvest. And obviously, if it's the winter solstice, well, it's a time to celebrate the return of the sun and the fact that spring and summer will come again. So very, very practical purposes to these things. Now to the next slide. And these are rather similar things that were actually built in North America. They were built by Plains Indians, basically using stones. And this one in Montana is not that old. But the oldest one, again, goes back to that same general period as Stonehenge, about 3000 BC. And like Stonehenge, these circles, these structures are aligned with astronomical parameters. And they're designed to give you an information on the timing of the seasons. This seems to be their primary function here. So let's just have a look at a little text review of these things here. They all seem to be various forms of calendars, determining when you should plant your crops, harvest your crops, and so on. At Stonehenge, the center and the surrounding stones define directions for the summer solstice and other important celestial events such as the spring equinox and the autumn equinox, the fall equinox. So they have very practical significance. They might have seen a few grisly sacrifices one time or another, pure speculation, but their primary function was to act as calendars, to tell people what time of year it was and to direct their activity. So there's an important function for celestial observations. Next slide. The earliest astronomy observatory that's known in the Americas is actually in Peru. It's in South America. It's on a mountain ridge. And this is a series of towers that basically do the same thing. At different times of the year, the sun will rise in different places between these towers. They're slightly inaccurate now, as is Stonehenge and some of these ancient monuments, and we'll talk in a moment about why that is. But essentially, this had a very similar function. It's now been made a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So at various points in the year, the sun will rise through those between these towers and give the ancient Peruvians, the Incas, I guess they were, some indication of the timing of the seasons for their activities for agriculture. So early astronomy was really had a very practical purpose in a lot of respects. Next slide. Now, in addition to making kind of regular observations of things that led people to build these calendars and use celestial events to track the seasons, there are also various reports of strange things happening. There's a report of a meteorite. This is a picture from 1492 of a meteorite landing in Germany. And there were other reports of suddenly bright stars. We're all familiar with the legend of the Star of Bethlehem. These are unusual events in the skies that sometimes the reports are hard to verify, but they're certainly there. So people were watching for these things. And that's actually a piece of the meteorite that fell in 1492, I'm given to understand. So ancient peoples were looking at the skies to use them as a calendar, but also to record unusual events, many of which would have been ascribed religious significance or particularly kind of prophetic significance in some cases. So to the next slide now, we end up then with a challenge between what you might call practical astronomy and theoretical astronomy. An accurate calendar was pretty important for a lot of things. And that seems to be the primary function of these things. But all the observations that were made by these ancient structures that were built thousands and thousands of years ago indicated complexity. If you looked at these observations for a long time, you would have to ask yourself, well, what does this mean? Why does this happen? How can we construct explanations for this? So this is really the beginning of theoretical astronomy, when this idea of understanding the science or the meaning behind celestial motions takes over from the purely practical aspect of recording them and using them to define a calendar. So let's go to the next slide now. So there are some things that ancient astrologers or observers of the heavens could see all the time. They could observe them, not every day, but they could certainly observe them on a recurring basis. So every day there's a motion of the sun that goes through the sky. They would also note that the changes in the sunset, timing of sunrise and sunset, the length of the day, and the position of the sky all change with the passing of the seasons. So in other words, in the summertime, the sun is higher in the sky, the place where it rises is slightly different on the horizon, and the length of the day is obviously different. Now similarly, the moon goes through the sky and also defines the phases of the moon. Okay? The moon is illuminated in various ways over a 30-day cycle approximately, a 28-day cycle I guess, and it defines the concept of months, although today the lunar months are not exactly the same as the calendar months. Now at night time you could see the moon as well. The moon is still illuminated in the night, if it's in the sky, and you can see the stars and the many patterns in them. Now the patterns in the stars appear to remain fixed. There's no indication to ancient observers that they changed at all. But nevertheless, the individual constellations, the groups of stars that people observe, would move through the sky, through the day, through the night, and through the seasons too. They would be in different places too. And almost certainly, ancient observers would have noted that there are some strange stars that seem to actually wander through the stars in patterns that are unusual but ultimately predictable. So most of the stars stay in the same relative positions, but some of them move through the pattern of the stars. And once in a while, you would see interesting, unusual, infrequent, and probably rather scary events, particularly solar eclipses, would be extremely important things for ancient observers because it appears that the sun is disappearing. Lunar eclipses are a little harder to observe, but nevertheless, they would have noticed these things too, when the moon went dark in the middle of the night, for example. So there's a bunch of things that could have been observed over time, and they must have thought about these things and tried to understand what they represent. So let's take a moment to understand what they do represent with our modern knowledge now, and consider this a sort of introduction to some of the motions and the concepts involved in the geometry of the solar system. So let's first of all look at the sun's path. That's really the first thing we need to look at. So what the sun does is it goes through the sky every day, showing up over the horizon somewhere in the east and then disappearing somewhere in the west in slightly different positions. Its path is going to change through the year. In the summer, it's going to be highest above the horizon in the middle of the day, and it's going to be lowest in the winter. In the wintertime, the sun has a low angle. The length of the day changes with the seasons, and only rarely is the day the same length as the night if you time it. It only happens a couple of times a year. So if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, you would see different paths at different times. On December the 21st, the sun wouldn't be in the sky for very long, and it wouldn't get very high in the sky. On June 21st, it would be in the sky for a long time, and it would be overhead, perhaps, at the middle of the day. And on March 21st and September the 1st, 21st, 22nd, it would be somewhere in between. Okay? So that's the pattern that's observed. And of course, the reason for that is because the Earth's rotation axis is tipped with respect to its path around the sun, as we'll see in the next diagram. Next slide. So the seasons we see result from the tilting of the Earth's rotation axis. On December the 21st, the axis is tilted away from the sun in the Earth's orbit, and that's northern winter. So it means the sun has a lower angle and less sunlight is present in the northern hemisphere per unit area. On June 21st, it's the other way around. The axis of rotation is tilted towards the sun, so the northern hemisphere is receiving more direct sunlight and a larger amount of sunlight. And of course, it's the reverse in the southern hemisphere. March 21st and September 22nd are the equinoxes, okay? And that's a time when the Earth's axis of rotation is actually oriented parallel to the sun, if you like. It's not pointing towards it, and it's not pointing away from it. And the word equinox actually means equal nights, okay? It's a time when the day and the night have approximately the same length. So, here's an explanation for why the Earth has seasons, a very simple explanation, okay? Our rotation axis is not at right angles to our orbit around the sun. If the Earth's rotation axis was at right angles to the plane of our orbit around the sun, then we wouldn't have seasons, okay? How warm or how cold it would just depend on your latitude, and it wouldn't really change through the year. So that's the explanation for that particular factor. So let's have a look now at the next slide and try and understand why this would be important. These dates in the calendar are the origin of many festivals. We celebrate winter solstice in December. It's called Christmas now, but it's an ancient time of celebration. That means that spring will come again. It's when the days start to get longer again and you feel that warmth is coming back. The spring equinox or the vernal equinox is when you start planting your crops in the northern hemisphere. And the fall equinox is probably when you start harvesting them. Now, we think about these patterns as being permanent and unchanging. And they are in terms of our own periods of observation. But over time, the Earth's rotation axis actually wobbles. It doesn't really stay in quite the same place. Okay? Its attitude, its inclination shifts a little bit, but it also moves around in its position. So there will eventually come a time, many, many thousands of years in the future, when June, July, and August might correspond with the northern winter. So the calendars actually shift in time. We see them as permanent, but they're not. They do shift slightly in time, which is why some of these ancient structures are no longer as accurate as they were would originally have been. Okay? So that deals with the sun. Now, what about the moon? Let's look at the moon now. Let's have a look at the next slide. So the moon does a similar thing to the sun. It follows an east to west path through the sky every day, and it's higher or lower in the sky with the seasons as well. Okay? A full moon will usually appear on the eastern horizon sometime around dusk. And then we have what we call waxing moons, which is where it's becoming progressively more illuminated at different points in their transit through the sky. And then we have the waning phases. We have a full moon when it's completely illuminated. And then we have waning phases, which usually occur on the eastern horizon partway through the night. So a waxing moon is growing and a waning moon is disappearing, and it eventually gives way to a new moon when the moon is almost invisible, just maybe a very thin line that we can see, and then the whole process starts again. So this is the origin of the months which we use in the calendar. They're based on these lunar months that pass through over time. And this is a regular cycle, and as many of you probably know, the lunar cycle is hardwired into many organisms on the Earth, including us too. Okay, so this is an important thing, and it's very interesting to think about how this came about to be, and we'll talk about that later on. So the moon has very predictable behavior, and ancient observers were able to predict this, and were also able to use the moons as a means of tracking time through the year as well. Next slide. Now, occasionally, you will get a partial or total eclipse of the sun. So, this is an unusual event, and it's not seen from everywhere on the Earth's surface. It would only be seen at particular times from certain places on the Earth's surface. And a solar eclipse can only occur when there is a new moon. It has to be a new moon for there to be a solar eclipse. But there isn't a solar eclipse every time there's a new moon. Okay? You don't get one every month. You get one infrequently, and they're only seen in certain places. Now, it's easy to see why eclipses were probably seen as rather terrible events. Okay? They would have been pretty scary for early peoples, and they are very strange. If you've ever seen an eclipse, it's a rather strange event. So can we predict eclipses? Well, we can predict eclipses, but the ancient observers didn't really have a knowledge of the geometry and the things that result in eclipses, but they did have a knowledge of history because eclipses were recorded. So obviously, if something's recorded and you have a means of measuring time with calendars, then you can look for patterns in their appearance. So they were able to predict eclipses to some extent, but not entirely, okay, because they are quite difficult to collect. To predict, because they only occur at certain times. It has to be a new moon, but it's not every new moon. And when we get a total eclipse like this, we often see the solar corona, the atmosphere around the sun, which normally we can't see because of the brightness of the sun. So that's a solar eclipse. But what about a lunar eclipse? Let's have a look at the next slide now. Now, it's more common to see a lunar eclipse, because the moon becomes darkened for a relatively brief period of time. And actually, we don't always notice these very much. Now, lunar eclipses are the opposite of solar eclipses because they can only happen when there's a full moon. A lunar eclipse can only happen when the moon is full. But once again, there isn't a lunar eclipse every time there's a full moon. So can they also be predicted on a regular cycle? Well, again, the answer is yes and no. Ancient observers didn't have a knowledge of the geometry that leads to this, but they were able to look at the records, and in many cases they could do a pretty good job of predicting when a lunar eclipse would occur in particular places. So this is a sequence of images taken during a lunar eclipse, and it shows how the moon is progressively cast into shadow. Now, sometimes lunar eclipses can be sort of scary, especially if you get what's called a blood moon. And a blood moon is a rather spectacular event that's caused by a particular geometric arrangement between the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon. So this is a blood moon. This wasn't taken on May 26, 2021, because it was cloudy in St. John's, I'm sure of that, but it was taken somewhere else. And they form when the light from the Sun is passing through the Earth's atmosphere and illuminating the Moon. And the light from the Sun, because it passes through the Earth's atmosphere, the blue wavelengths, the shorter wavelengths, are absorbed, and the red wavelengths dominate, so we end up with this moon that's lit up by a red sun, which is quite spectacular. So, of all the things that ancient people looked at, eclipses were probably the most problematic, because they wanted to be able to predict them, because they were ascribed quite a lot of significance from a predictive point of view and from a religious point of view, but they were quite difficult to predict. The records weren't always accurate, so therefore ancient astrologers would predict eclipses which wouldn't show up, or they'd fail to predict eclipses and they would show up, and then they'd be in a lot of trouble. So maybe what we should do now is let's actually think about what causes lunar eclipses and solar eclipses and try and understand from this, get a little bit of insight into the geometry of the solar system. So let's go to the next slide now. This is slide 22. I'm sorry, I haven't been giving you numbers so far on this podcast. I'll try and do that from now on. Causes of solar variations and eclipses. Well, we understand this stuff now because we have knowledge of the geometry of the solar system and its motions. But it was very, very difficult for ancient observers to get a clear understanding of this. And that's largely because the concept of most ancient observers was always that the Earth is the center of the universe. In other words, everything is moving around the Earth and the Earth is standing still. Now, of course, we know that's not true. The Earth rotates around the Sun, and it certainly isn't the center of the universe. So we know now that the Sun rises and sets because of the Earth's rotation. The Sun isn't moving around the Earth. It just looks that way. The variations in the year are due to the inclination of the Earth's rotation axis, which changes the apparent path if you're at one particular place on the Earth. So we understand that quite well. Okay? The phases of the moon basically record changes in the illumination of the moon from our viewpoint as the moon orbits around us. You'll often hear that phrase, the dark side of the moon. Well, the dark side of the moon is not always dark. There is no dark side of the moon. The dark side of the moon gets just as much light as the side of the moon we're familiar with. It's just that we don't see it. So the moon is illuminated by the sun, and we see variations in the degree of illumination. Eclipses occur in two ways. Okay? A solar eclipse is when the moon's shadow moves across the surface of the Earth. In other words, the moon is between the Earth and the sun. Okay? A lunar eclipse is when the Earth's shadow moves across the moon. So it's when the Earth's shadow is doing this, is when the Earth comes between the sun and the moon. Okay? And these events all result from orbital motions in the solar system. So that explains right away why you can only have a solar eclipse when there's a new moon, because the moon has to be lit from behind. It has to be between us and the sun. And you can only have a lunar eclipse on a full moon because the Earth has to be between the sun and the moon. And all of these things relate to orbital motions in the solar system. But why is it that we don't see eclipses at every new moon or full moon? Well, this, of course, is related to another concept that's very important in understanding the solar system. So we'll take a moment to introduce that in the next slide. So, from this came the concept of what we call the ecliptic plane. So the ecliptic plane takes its name because this is the plane in which ellipses will always occur. Okay, in the sky. It's a plane in the sky where ellipses occur and also where other celestial motions occur. Now, scientifically, the ecliptic plane is a plane that includes the Earth's orbit around the sun and the center of the sun. It's called that because this is the only place an eclipse can occur. And the reason eclipses don't occur all the time is quite simple. The orbit of the moon around the Earth is not in the ecliptic plane. Okay, the moon is inclined to the ecliptic plane, as are some other planetary bodies. Mercury, for example, is inclined to the ecliptic plane as well. But most planets orbit the sun within the ecliptic plane or very close to it. And we use the term node for a point where an orbit crosses the ecliptic plane. And this explains why it's hard to predict various types of eclipses. Next slide. Eclipses only occur when the moon's orbit crosses the ecliptic plane. It's not in the same plane as our orbit around the sun. So a solar eclipse requires two things. The moon must be at a node, it must be in the ecliptic plane, it must be crossing the plane that joins the Earth and the sun, and it must be between us and the sun. So two things have to happen in order to do that. Now, if you know that, it's easy to predict eclipses, and we do this very easily now with computers. The ancient observers, they did pretty well, but mostly they did this by careful study of historical records, because there are indeed clear periodic patterns amongst ellipses. There's a thing called the Soros cycle that links them over long periods of time, and given sufficiently accurate records, you can use it to predict an eclipse. So, there's a little lesson, first of all, in an important aspect of the solar system geometry. The ecliptic plane is very important feature of the solar system. It's the plane that contains the orbits of most of the planets around the sun very closely, but not everything moves in the ecliptic plane. So let's have a look at the next slide now. So this is just a visual representation of why this is the case. If you like, this is eclipses 101. Okay, the upper panel in the diagram shows what happens most of the time. The moon is not in the ecliptic plane. It's out of the ecliptic plane by about 5 degrees. So that means that its shadow doesn't touch the Earth, and the Earth's shadow doesn't touch the moon, whether it's at a new moon or a full moon. So you can have a new moon or a full moon and you won't see an eclipse. The bottom panel shows the circumstances when you get an eclipse. This is when the moon is actually in the ecliptic plane, it's crossing the ecliptic plane. So if circumstances are right, its shadow will touch the Earth's surface somewhere. Okay? And at other times, the Earth's shadow will envelop the moon. The Earth's shadow, of course, is much bigger than the moon's shadow because the moon is a lot smaller than the Earth. Okay? So this is why you only see a narrow band on Earth where you'll see a total eclipse, a solar eclipse. Only certain places on the Earth's surface will actually see that, because it depends on the moon's position relative to the ecliptic plane and the Earth's surface. And in fact, in the next slide, we can see where some of these eclipses would occur over time and will occur in the future. Next slide. So here's a map, and it shows some predictions for eclipses. Okay, the last time we had one was back, not sure when actually. We're due for one in 2024, it appears. Okay, and it's a pretty good bet that on April the 8th, 2024, it's going to be foggy in St. John's at that time of year, but you can but hope. And you can see that these are narrow tracks. Only narrow regions show this. Now, those ones you see in the north there that appear really wide, that's a bit of an optical illusion. That's really to do with the distortion in the map projection, because that map projection is, in fact, it's a circuit. The Earth is a sphere, of course, and we've turned it into a flat rectangular projection here, which changes the scale in polar regions. Okay? The width of the track also depends on the distance between the Earth and the Moon, too, because the distance between the Earth and the Moon changes during its orbit. Its orbit is what we call eccentric. So that means that sometimes the track is wider than at other times, and sometimes we get rather peculiar effects, such as things that we call annular eclipses that we'll talk about later on. So that kind of takes care of eclipses. With our modern knowledge, we can understand why this happens. I think it's easy to understand why it was a great source of confusion for ancient observers. So let's have a look at the next slide now. That's where the ecliptic is in the sky, roughly speaking. Okay, we can put a line through the sky, and that's where the eclipses would have to occur. The moon has to be pretty much in that plane for an eclipse to occur, during the day or during the night, depending on when it is. Now, other things move in the ecliptic too. And in fact, the wandering stars that we call planets basically all move within the ecliptic too. So the ecliptic is a physical feature in the sky. Its position relative to the observer will change with the seasons, but it's always within this plane that we see the planets move too, because that's the plane that most of the planets orbit in relative to the sun. So again, a very important concept there. So let's move along now to the next slide and talk a little bit about the stars and the patterns that they define. So what do the stars do? Well, they do the same kind of thing in the night as the sun and the moon do too, during the day and in the night as well. They go from east to west on a daily basis. But the patterns that we see in them, what we call the constellations, appear to be fixed as they move across the sky. They don't change. But unlike the sun and the moon, some constellations are only visible from particular places at particular times of the year, and some of them are only visible from one hemisphere. There are constellations that you see in the southern hemisphere, the Southern Cross is the best example, that you won't ever see in the northern hemisphere. So they're different. They're obviously behaving in a different way to the sun and the moon. However, if you watch long enough, the constellations will always return to the same location at the same time in one place from one year to another. So they're extremely predictable. Those patterns are very, very predictable. And some of them are very useful too. The one called Polaris is particularly important because it basically appears over the North Pole. That's where it is, okay? At least with reference to our history. But Polaris was not always the North Star. Other stars have had that role because, once again, this effect is caused by the position of the Earth's rotation axis, and the Earth's rotation axis does move over time. It's not always in the same place over a period of thousands of years. So what are constellations anyway? Do they have any real significance? Let's have a look at the next slide. So there are 88 constellations in the sky, and these are constellations that humans have long interpreted as patterns. And in most cases, different cultures in different parts of the world gave them different names. One curious factor is that the one that we call the Great Bear, or Ursa Major, has always been linked by bears to bears by different people in different parts of the world, which is very strange. Okay? The individual stars that make up a constellation actually are very different positions relative to the Earth. Some of them could be much further away than others. So what we see is essentially an accidental pattern. If we were to look at the same group of stars from some other part of the galaxy, they'd look quite different again. So that's an illustration of the constellation Orion, one of the best known constellations. Very, very easy to identify in the sky because of the three bright stars that make its belt. And we'll be going to Orion in the future as well, because it's an important place for the formation of planets too, what's called the Orion Nebula. But anyway, constellations have no real significance. However, they do have some usefulness in astronomy and in terms of identifying regions of the sky. So let's look at the next slide. They're pretty much random, but they're the basis of what you might call heavenly geography, because those constellations divide the sky into regions. So they provide a pretty useful reference if you're going to describe where something is in the sky at night. So some examples, there's a meteor shower that comes in late July and early August every year, a very spectacular meteor shower. It's called the Perseids. And that's because it's mostly in the region of the sky that contains the constellation Perseus. The Orion Nebula, which I mentioned just a moment ago, is a region of stellar formation and planetary formation, and it sits within the constellation Orion. It just happens to be in that same line of sight, but that's where it is in the sky, that's where it gets its name, and it's a handy reference too. So constellations are constructs of the human imagination, but nevertheless have some practical value. So let's move along now and think about the planets, which behave in a slightly different way again. Planets are different, okay? In one night, they're going to move from east and west along with the stars. But over the course of many nights' observation, a planet won't stay fixed relative to the stars. Usually, it will appear to travel slowly from west to east through the positions of the stars, through the patterns that we see in the stars. And all planets move pretty much on the same track through the sky. And that track is what we call the ecliptic plane. That's the same plane that the sun will occupy at a given time, and also the moon too. Okay, so this motion is really how planets get their name, because the word planet comes from an ancient Greek word which means traveller or wanderer, because they wander through the pattern of the stars. And there were five planets that were easily visible with the naked eye, and that's Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn. And of course, they were all gods in the Roman pantheon and most pantheons of the world, too. And the sun and the moon were also considered as planets by the ancient astronomers, because they also move against the background of the stars. They're in different places, relatively speaking. Okay? Their position will change through the year where they're located. So that brings us then to the concept of the zodiac, which is a slightly more nebulous concept that's linked to astrology. But we might as well mention it. The sun, the moon, and the planets all basically move across the sky in approximately the same path or plane. And that's what we call the ecliptic, because ecliptics always occur in that plane. As the planets travel along the ecliptic, they move from west to east, and they move through 12 specific constellations that sit in the ecliptic. And those constellations are the ones that are supposed to have that astrological significance. Okay? The signs of the zodiac, the names we give them, they represent the constellations where the sun would sit with respect to the position of the sky at particular times of the year. But you can't actually see the sun and the stars together, but you can equate their position from night to day, if you like. So I'm a Pisces. I was born on March the 3rd, and most of you probably have a star sign too. Does it make any difference? Not really. Astrology is definitely a pseudoscience. It doesn't really have any significance. So the zodiac has no real astronomical or significance within the context of the solar system or the galaxy. It's just something that's been invented over years by human beings looking for a higher power or something that might influence their lives. So let's move along from that. We'll put that one aside. What do celestial motions mean? Well, we got a pretty good understanding these days, but you can imagine that these observations caused a few problems in the past. And those problems, again, boil down to the fact that most people who observed the sky in olden times had an Earth-centered view. Now, we know that the movement of the stars is also due to the Earth's rotation. The Earth moves, so the stars appear to move. However, the ancients thought of them as actually rotating around us, because we were the center of the universe. So they thought of them as the celestial sphere, a faraway sphere that the stars were attached to, kind of like little holes, if you like, in the ceiling. And similarly, the planets, including the sun and the moon, were assumed to move around the Earth in some clearly defined fashion so that they would move through the backdrop of the celestial sphere, but they would be inside it. So therefore, they appear to move against the backdrop because they were actually inside the celestial sphere. That worked okay some of the time, but didn't work okay all the time, because planets occasionally decide to go backwards. Planets sometimes will go from west to east for a little while instead of east to west, and then head off west again. Okay, so that's rather strange behavior. Okay, sometimes they go reverse direction, basically. And this is called retrograde motion. And this caused a lot of difficulty to explain in models for the movement of celestial objects. Now, eventually, an explanation was developed over time, and we'll talk about this when we talk about the development of astrology and astronomy in the ancient Greeks. And it gave a fairly consistent answer. It actually provided an explanation for why the planets did this, but that doesn't mean it was right. It was a model that managed to make the right prediction, but was actually the wrong cause. So an example, if we didn't have computers back then, but it was a model that took the wrong assumptions, gave an answer that made sense, but was actually wrong. So we'll come back to that later on. Let's just look at a couple of other things that we see in the skies, or that ancient people would have seen in the skies, and understand what these things might be. So let's have a look at the next slide now. Comets. Now, early observers did a pretty amazing job of explaining celestial motions and predicting them, especially when you consider that their theories are essentially wrong. But there were some things they can't predict or could not predict, and we can't predict them now. And one of these is the appearance of comets. The appearance of comets to ancient observers seemed to be completely unpredictable. Okay? Many of them would only be seen by one generation of observers. Same thing applies to what we call supernovas. Suddenly bright stars, exploding stars. And these were examples of things that there seemed to be no way to predict. Now, eventually, a man named Edmund Halley did figure out that comets actually had a recurring pattern. Halley's comet was the first comet to be recognized to have such a pattern. But many comets essentially appear to be unpredictable events, and many of them may indeed be single events that never are repeated, depending on the kind of orbit that they have. So ancient observers could observe a variety of different things, and we have a good explanation for what we see in the skies now from our modern understanding of motions in the solar system. Okay? In particular, the concept of the ecliptic plane. The reason that the planets and the sun and the moon all essentially move within that plane or very close to it is that that's the plane of rotation of objects or movement of objects, the revolution of objects within the solar system around the sun. But the ancient observers, of course, had it the other way around. They thought the sun went around the Earth rather than the Earth going around the sun. So let's just change gear a little bit now. We're in a different age of exploration science now. We're well beyond all of that. We have a good knowledge of motions within the solar system and the components of the solar system, but we've still only managed to get to one other world in the solar system, and that was 52 years ago when Apollo 11 landed on the moon. Okay, but nevertheless, in that 52 years, we've come an amazing distance in our powers of observation. And we have many methods now for examining the solar system and learning about it that weren't available to ancient people. Now, the telescope's not a new invention. It was invented well before Galileo. Galileo is often credited with inventing the telescope, but he didn't invent the telescope, he just used it. But modern telescopes, of course, are incredibly sophisticated compared to those that we used for many years for observing the heavens. So let's just have a look at some of these things. The telescope really changed our knowledge of the solar system. It allowed much better observations of the positions and the speeds and the timing of interplanetary or celestial objects from the Earth, and gave us new pictures about it. It allowed the discovery of new planets. It allowed the rings of Saturn to be observed. It allowed Galileo to see the moons of Jupiter through a telescope and the craters on the surface of the moon. So really it made a huge difference, and eventually it allowed for the discovery of the planets Uranus and Neptune and ultimately Pluto, although Pluto is no longer considered to be a planet. So now we have telescopes in orbit. This was the first orbital telescope here. This is the Hubble telescope, and this provides us with amazing images of the universe and the galaxy, things that we could never get from Earth because of the interference of the Earth's atmosphere. So that's one reason why we're able to see so much more now and understand so much more. to the next slide now. It's a couple of Hubble images. The Cat's Eye Nebula, I think you can see why it's called the Cat's Eye Nebula. And the Crab Nebula, which is a remnant of an exploding star from many, many thousands of years ago. These are images from the Hubble telescope of greater clarity and greater precision than anything we were able to get in the past. So we'll have a look at the next slide now. As I mentioned before, we make extensive use of other types of electromagnetic radiation. Back in the old days, there was no way to look at any of this stuff. We were essentially restricted to looking at visible images. But now we have the entire electromagnetic spectrum to work with. So this allows much more precise observation of objects within the solar system and a much better understanding of what we see. And an example we used before, and we'll just use it again too, is the example of Venus, where we can't see the surface. We can't really see much in the clouds, but by using ultraviolet we can see the clouds very well, and by using microwave radar observations we can understand more about the surface. Just a couple more pictures to follow up, actually, some pictures that come from recent images of Venus. There's an image of a volcano, okay? The yellow is a false color. That's a large, flat, kind of shield volcano. We talked about shield volcanoes in a previous class. And there's also some images in 3D topography. So these come from radar imaging of the Venusian surface. Volcanoes on Venus are a possible source for phosphine that some people suggest could be related to bacterial life in the clouds of the planet. But that's an issue we'll come back to later on. So let's move on a little bit. Different regions of the spectrum allow us a much better understanding of the sun too. We couldn't really observe the sun easily at all for many, many hundreds or thousands of years. But now we're able to see it in great detail, and you can see that its features are different in different regions of the spectrum. Sunspots are more energetic regions, which is why they show up as bright images on the ultraviolet images that we see there, and also the X-ray images. So these are all remote sensing methods. They give us a lot of insight into planetary bodies, and we can now look at the surfaces of the Moon and Mars with a topographic resolution that's just as good as anything that we have from Earth. We have orbital spacecraft that have laser altimeters on there that give us incredibly detailed topography, so we can look at things like individual drainage channels and individual features. Infrared methods give us information about the composition of the surfaces of objects within the solar system, so these are also very powerful too. And finally, we can measure geophysical properties of many bodies in the solar system now. We can measure gravity fields and magnetic fields. This tells us something about internal structures. One other thing we have that's really quite remarkable too, and a very important tool in planetary science, is shown here. We also have direct samples of material that come from other parts of the solar system too. And they come to Earth in the form of meteorites. This is Barringer Crater in Arizona, which is about 50,000 years old. This was formed by the Canyon Diablo meteorite. It's quite a famous meteorite. It's had a lot of scientific work done on it. It's probably only about 100 meters in diameter. It was actually an iron meteorite for the most part. So this is a sample that comes from somewhere else in the solar system and has arrived on Earth. And we don't only get stuff that comes from minor bodies within the solar system, or what we call the asteroid belt. We do also get meteorites that come from other planets. These are messenger meteorites from Mars. Okay? They've been blasted off the surface of the Mars by large impacts in the distant past and have then made their way to the Earth much more recently. And we know they came from Mars because we can match gases in these meteorites to the Martian atmosphere. So we actually have pieces of Mars that arrive on the Earth for us to look at. The ancients had no idea about this, of course. So we do have some direct samples collected from other planets as well. Most of the ones we have come, of course, from the Moon. The American astronauts brought back about 380 kilograms of rock samples, which provide a lot of information about the composition and age of the lunar surface. We can work with these things as if they're terrestrial rocks. We've actually got seismometers on the Moon that measure moonquakes. They're very, very small, but they do exist. And we've also brought back material from comets too, which is kind of an interesting story that we'll talk about later. And in the end, this is really one of the most important things that we need to do in the future, is to be able to directly look at things on other planets. But that's obviously not the case at the moment. So let's just look at a couple of other things before we clue up for the day. Well, first of all, the Moon isn't made of green cheese. Turns out that lunar rocks are pretty much the same thing that we find in lots of parts of Earth. They're basalts. The light areas in the moon are mostly made of anorthosite, which is a rock mostly made of plagioclase feldspar. These were terms that we introduced in the last class. And the dark areas are basalt. So, no green cheese, just boring old basalt that we've seen loads and loads of times on Earth. So, the other thing that's been important, of course, is robotic exploration of the planets. Now, back in the 1970s, when I was a teenager, we all figured that we'd be visiting the moon regularly as tourists within a couple of decades, and we'd soon be wandering around on other planets. That's what we thought. That hasn't happened. It's much more affordable and way safer to explore other planets using robotic space probes. And that technology, as I mentioned before, had important impacts on science and everyday things that we use now, things that we take for granted, like cell phones and iPads, really all come from research that was generated by space exploration. So some pretty important missions have now gone to the inner planets, especially to Mars, and we've also gone out into the outer solar system. I mentioned before the Voyager missions, which took advantage of a planetary alignment that allowed a spacecraft to visit the four outer planets all in one mission. And this is really the main focus these days in planetary research, is robotic exploration. But in the end, it would be great to be able to go there, and I certainly hope that that will happen. Okay? There are people who believe that as well. There's a group called the Mars Society that actually operates a Mars Desert Research Station. So there are geologists who are crazy enough to put on spacesuits and pretend they're doing field work in the desert as a proxy for actually exploring Mars in person. And hopefully that will be something that comes about in the centuries to come, that we will be able to explore other planets in person and gain the sort of insight that we have about the Earth. In the meantime, we have to make do with the rovers. We have things like Curiosity, which is still active on Mars. We have a new rover on Mars too. Okay, and we have also missions that have gone to comets to try and bring things back too. Okay? The Mars rover programs, I think, are probably one of the most impressive achievements of planetary science in recent times. Spirit and Opportunity went there in 2004. Curiosity more recently. Okay? And they've travelled around considerable areas on Mars, collected rock samples, analysed rocks, taken probably millions of photographs of the landscapes of Mars. Many of these landscapes are very reminiscent of earthly landscapes, as you can see in this picture. Curiosity went there in 2012, and Curiosity is exploring a specific region where we have evidence for ancient sedimentary rocks that suggests that water existed in the past there. And the instruments allow simple analytical work. They can identify minerals and rocks, and they can get high-resolution digital images too. So Mars is certainly a fascinating place. And the most recent of the Mars rovers, of course, is this one. This is Perseverance, which just went there this year. Okay, Perseverance actually has its own helicopter. This is the Ingenuity helicopter. So this is the first helicopter ever to operate on another world. It's amazing that you can do this on Mars because the air is extremely thin on Mars. And this is one of the pictures that's taken from the Ingenuity helicopter here. So you can see the tracks of the Perseverance rover here as it flies over it. So we're looking forward to a lot more information to come from these programs. So I think we're pretty much at the end of this one. This is pretty much the last slide. This is another Martian landscape. This is a photo from the Opportunity rover. And I think if you look at this and you look back at the pictures that we showed in the last set of presentations, the last module about the Grand Canyon and about sedimentary rocks, I think you can see that these are in fact sedimentary rocks. And that's what they are. These are layered, red-coloured sedimentary rocks that were deposited probably over 4 billion years ago by water on the surface of Mars. So there are familiar things on some of the planets. I'll just end with something else that's familiar. And that's a picture of the largest volcano in the solar system. This is Olympus Mons on Mars, which is very much akin to large terrestrial volcanoes such as Hawaii and some other large ones that exist within the oceans. So there are familiar things out there. And there are things that we don't understand very well. When we venture into the outer solar system, things become very different and very much is unknown. But we now have a lot of capability for understanding the evolution of the solar system and its anatomy too. So that's it for this particular presentation, for the first part of this module. There's a series of summary slides that follow this one that summarize some of the main points in the presentation that you can look at in terms of solidifying your knowledge. So I'm glad to have another one of these things done. I'll be back again before too long, though, with the second part of this presentation, when we're going to look at the wider context of the solar system in the galaxy and the universe. So that'll contain some other information that will, I think, interest you. Certainly some information about the vastness of the galaxy and the universe. Thank you very much. Have a good evening, and we'll see you again, or you'll hear me again, before too long.